Dr. Hansen from the University of Delaware is going to talk to us about the Chesapeake Bay. Thank you.
Okay, we have to rock and roll because I'm adapting on the fly based on some of the other presentations, and so it's a good thing there's this pointless 10-minute break between me and Chris, because I'll go all the way to 3. Adaptive management for the Chesapeake Bay. My co-author is Rich Batuk, who is with the Chesapeake Bay program. He is an EPA person, and I am not. I'm with the University of Delaware. So if I say things that sound like they're taking shots at EPA, they probably are. Why talk about the bay? I mean, we're not even in the bay watershed right now, right? We're just skipped outside. And really, the single biggest reason is because a lot of people are watching what happens in the bay watershed to see how does it work. We're trying to address these agriculture and water quality issues. The model is central to everything that's going on, even in terms of regulation. And so I think it's got some utility even outside the watershed. And then, you know, why you would be a reasonable question. And it's because in the last 4 years or so, I've been more involved in the Bay program. I'm on the STAC, or Scientific Technical Advisory Committee. I'm the Delaware representative on that. And then I am presently co-chair of one of the 6 goal implementation teams. And I'll talk about that in a little bit, because we're going to get to talking about regulation, and then in the end, talking about something that Jerry Lemunyan brought up, which is just perfect, because that's where I was going with this. Fighting blue hens, I got to put that up there. Right? Okay, so I'm going to a little bit about the watershed, about the Chesapeake Bay program itself, and then try to tie the adaptive management thing in 2 different ways. And one is what I was calling structural, but based on what Tom Morris said, I think I would call bureaucratic adaptive management in the function of the program itself. And then getting to this idea of, in the environment where we have increased regulations and a lot of things that are based on modeling, and that, how do we take information from adaptive management studies and get them plugged back into getting some kind of environmental credit for doing these practices or suite of practices? And it's no small thing. And I don't have an answer. I'm doing the easy part, right? I'm just throwing this out. For those of you, I'm just going to flip this up. That's a 64,000 square mile watershed. There's 6 states and the District of Columbia involved. 10,000 miles of shoreline, which is what's interesting about that is that that's more shoreline than the West Coast has of the U.S. So there's a considerable amount of shoreline, a lot of important plant and fish species. The bay itself is a big economic engine in the region, tourism-wise and natural resource-wise. And there's about 17 million people and counting in the watershed, which is like one of the single biggest environmental issues as we go into the future. And as of May of this year, the bay became a national treasure when President Obama said so in the executive order. And I'll talk about the executive order just briefly. If you look, the Bay program has been in existence 20 some odd years. And I know you probably can't read the caption. I'll just tell you what it says. All you got to look at is the squiggly line. And what we're looking at is water quality indicators. That one happens to be bay grass abundance. And if we go back to 85 up until 2007, we see that on the far left, there's kind of the gas tank that you're trying to fill. That's how much bay grass we're going for. And where we're at is maybe a third of the way there. And you don't see this striking upward trend over time. We can measure that in terms of the one on top on the right is dissolved oxygen, which is hovering around 12% of the goal, and at the bottom, water clarity in the mid-channel of the bay, which is also hovering around 12% and dropping. So the message here is that after billions of dollars and decades of work, water quality is not improving. This is a problem. Right. And it gets people pretty worked up. And it's this the endless and unavailing thing, you know, Sisyphus pushing the rock up. And unfortunately, the rock is kind of rolling back down over the top of us. You know, it's not just rolling past. And so we've got really big public relations and scientific issues. So people are worked up. There's news articles. But more formally, there are things that are addressing this issue just in the last few years and coming up in the next year or so here. And the one I mentioned, the Executive Order 13508 on May 12th of this year, was released by President Obama. And it's the first one of these for the Bay. So it was a big deal. And I don't have time to go into it, but my summary of a big point of the executive order is that it's telling the federal agencies to play together. So not to have all these siloed efforts. And so USDA is supposed to be talking to EPA, is supposed to be talking to Department of Energy, Department of Defense. But it doesn't stop there, because there's also a mandate to work then with the states and with organizations in the states. And the reason I say murkier is because the president can't make that happen. You know, he can beat on the federal agencies, but once it gets down to how is it working within the state, states still have a lot of autonomy there. I'm going to talk about the TMDL in just a minute. And then there's the HB 3265 that just came out, the reauthorization or the Restoration Act of 2009. And there's a couple of interesting things in there, one of which is that it would actually put in legislation the bay is going to get cleaned up by 2025. And if you thought that was already in legislation, no, it wasn't, right? Which is why we get to keep pushing back the finish line year after year, which is what people get worked up about. But also, just the part of the Clean Water Act, Section 117, that deals with the Chesapeake Bay, part of the requirement in this bill would be that the Obama executive order, especially the portion that has to do with new urban sources and stormwater runoff, would get inserted into the Clean Water Act. So now all of a sudden it's not a presidential idea, it's in the law. And what I think is interesting about that is this is going to go through Congress. How long do you think it's going to be before somebody in Missouri, or people live in Missouri still, John, right? Start looking at that and going, hey, if that's good enough for the Bay, how come we don't have, why don't we just apply this nationally? Right? Any weird things can happen as it goes through Congress, so we'll see. But there's a lot of things that are really pushing for results, results, results in the Bay program. Land use, you start talking about what are you going to do here? What's the big issue? Land use is huge. And so if you look at that is the outline of the Bay watershed. The land to water surface ratio in the Bay is 14 to 1, which is monstrous. And what it means is that more so than about any other water body in the world, what happens on the landscape has a huge impact on what happens in the water. And this is just a graph out of another publication showing the Chesapeake Bay and some other water bodies. The bottom line for this is you can't get there without dealing with land use issues. You can't get there by regulating point sources. It has to go down to what people are doing on the landscape, and agriculture, of course, is a big player, because if you look at the land uses, about 2/3 forest, 23% agriculture, and 12% developed. You may have seen graphs with different numbers, so have I, but I just got this from them yesterday, so if it's wrong, it's like really new and wrong, okay? But it's close enough, right? So you get the picture that forest is not really the big load issue. So what we're really looking at is the developed areas in agriculture. So if you shift then and look at where does the nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment come from, you can see agriculture 42% nitrogen, 46% of the phosphorus, and 72% of the sediment. So when you're focusing on land management issues, you're focusing on agriculture. And most of that is not point source agriculture or CAFOs, no matter how creative you get at describing what a CAFO is. Okay, see, that was a shot, right? What's interesting, I'll just point this out. I can say that because I'm not EPA. It says in the fine print that the wastewater loads for this are based on measurements. So wastewater loads were point source loads. But the other stuff is based on the average hydrology year. And between the lines then, what that means is it's modeled. Of course, it's non-point. It's not measured loads. It's just the rest, which that also gets some people interested. But this kind of information is what prompts the new special assistant to the EPA administrator, Chuck Fox, to say on national television that agriculture is by far the largest source of pollution to the Chesapeake Bay and is arguably the single source, biggest source of pollution to all the waters of the country. So again, you know, it's not just because, we're not just talking about this because of what's happening in the Bay. There's a huge focus in general on the ag sector. Now, I have to say something here about the bureaucratic part of the adaptive management, because I should. But I'm going to say it quick. So there are things in writing out there that require the Bay program to be operated in an adaptive management structure. The Chesapeake Action Plan last year, the executive order has language in it about using adaptive management. The Restoration Act of 2009 has adaptive management in it, and the TMDL sort of implicitly has adaptive management in it. Okay, so we'll talk about the TMDL in just a second. Again, everybody's seen these kinds of graphs, a flow chart for adaptive management. I'm not going to go through it. All I want to do is throw up. That is just sort of the generalized idea. What the Bay program has done is basically taken the same thing and added some of their own language. And this is easily available if you're really interested in this. Plus, I'll give you a title of a talk that's out there on the internet that really walks you through structurally or bureaucratically how adaptive management is working. So that's by Greg Allen. I'm not going to talk any more about that because what I really want to get to here is, shoot, I'm not quite there. Okay, fine. This, I mentioned, look down toward the bottom where the red box is. The only reason I put this up here is because that happens to be the goal implementation team that I'm co-chair on. And the only reason to bring that up, besides to make myself look important, is that my co-chair is Bob Carranzi from EPA. And his deal, what he is doing, is the Bay TMDL. What I'm doing in that water quality goal implementation team is, as practices come up that people, the states, want to implement to achieve water quality standards, how do you give them a value? You know, we're going to put in a cover crop. Well, how much of a nitrogen and phosphorus reduction do you get? You're going to do pasture management. All these kind of things have to have a number associated with them to go in the Bay model. That also comes through that goal team. So there's going to be a lot of action in the coming years here. The TMDL itself, the total maximum daily load, it's the biggest that has ever even been attempted. But it's huge. It's the whole watershed. There are 92 impaired segments. It's basically the watershed. Everything in it is going to have a TMDL by the end of next year, which means it has to go out for public comment by late next summer, which is going to be a trick. So we'll see what happens. But there's court-mandated deadlines on that. So why bring this up? Two things that I want to throw in here: reasonable assurance and consequences, and this pressures on the states, because it gets to the agricultural adaptive management piece. Now, this is just a map of dissolved oxygen. Dissolved oxygen in the Bay is really what's driving the TMDL right now. It could be driven by other things, submerged aquatic vegetation, you know, water clarity, but right now the driver on the TMDL is dissolved oxygen. Okay, reasonable assurance with this TMDL means something a little different than it has in other TMDLs that I've been involved with, in that it's saying, prove you can do this. If any of you have been involved in the TMDL process in your states, you sat around the table and you had a load you had to get to, and you strung together practices to get to that load, and we had conversations like, well, we're going to put in 3,000 acres of cover crops. And they said, well, how many acres do we have now? Well, this is like 48. But, you know, if we really worked with people, we could probably get there. So, yeah, that's right. And so you put it down, right? Because it's a paper exercise. And you wonder why the water quality goals were never achieved. There was really never any stick associated with that. And now there is. And the stick, I can't resist. Right? You think I'd grow out of it, but it just doesn't seem to happen. So consequences that EPA is talking about for the states is, if you're not getting to where you need to be, things like you're not going to be able to issue new permits for your point sources. Thank you. Potential impact on funding in your state, grant funding. Oh, didn't mean to do that. And if you're not getting it done with your non-point sources, we will tighten down your permits on your point sources to limit of technology and see how you like that. Because that's what EPA can do. EPA has authority over the point sources. And that's one of the sticks then over the states to do something with the non-point sources. So this is, I mean, it's serious, and it's a lot different than it has been. So what'll happen is that states are going to have to be creative in ways to achieve their nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment reductions. And when they develop their watershed implementation plans, okay, they're going to be pulling these together, and the allocation that they get in the TMDL and the benefit or the effectiveness that they get from the practices that they do all come through the Bay model. Well, not just through the, they are generated by the Bay model. And so where I'm going here is, well, I'll go to it in the next slide. I'm not going to talk about this. Cool pictures, a lot of different models. Okay. What will the states do? There's a bunch of different things that they are going to do already. And the only reason I'm flipping this up is because we're looking across the watershed, and in the next 2 years, the states have already committed to do things like a million acres of nutrient management, 300,000 acres in conservation tillage, and so forth. And I'm not going to take the time of looking at Pennsylvania and Maryland. Same thing. You've got a list of practices. Now, the thing to note here is that these are big aggregate reporting things. These are not site-specific. We were at these different farms, and they were doing these things. And in fact, for most of the practices, cover crops, the only way you get the number is from cost share programs. Not many acres and cover crops are reported that aren't cost shared. And so there's a real issue with the reporting, and everybody has to agree on what the effectiveness of that practice is. And here's where it gets sticky when we talk about, in my opinion, with the adaptive management stuff, because it's not a thing, it's a system. And it's not the same on this farm as on that farm. And at some point, if you want to plug into this program and you want the state wants to get credit for this stuff that's going on in the landscape, there has to be some benefit to the state. And it's going to influence, I think, the availability of cost share, the availability of technical assistance. It's not enough to say we're doing a better job managing nitrogen. We got to be able to say, as a result of these practices, we have a reduction in load to water of phosphorus, nitrogen, or sediment. Okay, I already mentioned that. So, can we do that? How can we define a practice? How do we define it when it's a suite of practices? Or if, can we do it in such a way that when we say adaptive management, we know that the end result is this? Probably can't do that without modeling it. Who will track it? Who will report it? And how do we get it in the model? Because, you know, like it or love it, and most people, I shouldn't say like it or love it or hate it, that catches more people, okay? The model is it. The model is the ultimate source of the information here. So, structurally or bureaucratically, the Bay program is doing adaptive management, and I think that there are opportunities and hurdles for incorporating what has been talked about in adaptive management here to really plug into the system so you're not around the edges and doing good work, but to be able to plug it in a water quality sense is going to be, it's going to be a challenge. So, done.
Okay. First of all, come here, Dave. I want to give a hand to David for his presentation. No longer. No. And then, Harold, you want to come here? I mean, now we have time for a break, 10 minutes, but we were not able to ask questions to Harold.
You mean I got done in time?
You got in time.
I meant to go three.
No, but I mean, but now okay. We have a, I think a, these two presentations, yeah, let him, get him okay. First and the question for both of them, so.
Yeah, the Bay model takes something like that into account in terms of delivery factors. And so the farther you are away from the main stem of the Bay, the less influence you have, but then the flip side of that is the less impact a management practice has. So in that sense, if that's what you're asking.
What you're saying, I mean, in the Journal of Soil and Water Conservation, I have read paper that you do all these practices and then you won't see the effect in 5 years. And that has been published by, you know.
Yeah, well, actually, that.
The problem I think we have is that the aquifers that are responsible for the buffering are fairly complex hydrologically. So I think, I'm not sure, I don't know the Chesapeake Bay model.
But no, neither do I. Actually, I'm glad you brought that up because this is a huge issue that I completely blew past. The requirements on the states in the TMDL and in the executive order are requirements to implement practices that will result in water quality. So in the short term, up to 2025 at least, the real thing is, are you doing the practices that you said you would do? Now, the adaptive management in that comes in, what if you're doing everything you said you would do and we said it was okay, EPA said it was okay, not we, EPA said it was okay, now what? You know, now you got to redraw the finish line. So it's not based really on water quality, it's based on assumed water quality from practices.
Okay, we have a question. Yeah, Peter, you let.
No, I was just going to follow up. I mean, if you look in terms of being watching areas that's had, you know, post-European, you know, colonization for 400 years, we have buffering not just in terms of the hydrology, but in terms of, you know, the historical impact of our loads. And from the standpoint of phosphorus, we have sources that are across the watershed that do require decades to bleed out, particularly in some of the hotspot areas. So the implementation of BMPs today may result in kind of near-term improvements to water quality around the field, but downstream, those impacts certainly will not be seen, and they're not included in the Bay model. And so I think that's a real issue that has to be addressed, and that a lot of people are dancing around.
Yeah, well, that's why the focus is on the practices, because right now it's a big political news flash. It's a big political issue, right? And so the line is drawn.